Chris Boyd. Up next on The Best of Think, writer Margaret Atwood. Her novel, The Handmaid's Tale, was published to wide acclaim, but for three decades, she declined to write anything further about the people in her fictional country of Gilead until now.
Instead of going away from Gilead, as we thought we were doing in the 90s, we turned around and started to come back towards it, as we are doing now.
Atwood's newest best-selling release is The Testaments. We'll talk about her choice to tell part of the new story using the cruel collaborator Aunt Lydia as a narrator. Our Best of Think conversation starts after a short break. The Republic of Gilead is a terrifying place, a merciless, violent theocracy run exclusively for the benefit of wealthy white men who maintain their stranglehold on society by depriving women and girls of education, employment, property, even access to the written word. Meanwhile, environmental degradation has left so many adults infertile that an underclass of so-called handmaids is enslaved to conceive children by a bizarre system of ritualized rape, only to have those children taken from them at birth to be raised by ruling families. It's a world nobody would want to live in. But since Margaret Atwood's classic work of speculative fiction, The Handmaid's Tale, was first published in 1985, it's a world no reader can forget. And now there's more to the story. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Atwood's new novel, The Testaments, picks up years after the story of the handmaid Offred left off in the original book. This time there are three narrators, one young woman raised in the home of a Gilead commander to be a true adherent to her society's views on virtue and vice, another raised across the border in Canada, appalled by the strange society festering to the south, and an older woman known as Aunt Lydia, who has managed to carve out power for herself the only way that it's possible in Gilead, by cooperating with the patriarchy to enforce brutal control over other women's bodies. The new novel is every bit as disturbing and as thought-provoking as the first, and it's a story its author has been thinking about for more than 30 years. Since its release, the book has topped the New York Times bestseller list and been awarded the Booker Prize for Fiction. Margaret Atwood joined us in September to talk about it. Margaret, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Offred's story has resonated with readers since The Handmaid's Tale was first published. Did you find yourself re-engaging with her story, with Aunt Lydia's story, with the story of the other characters in the years since you published The Handmaid's Tale in a way that is different than you've sort of kept up with books from your other characters from your other books?
Without a doubt, yes. So people have always been asking me to write a sequel. And I've always said no, because I thought they meant, and they did mean, to continue the story of Offred in the same voice, and that would not have been possible for me to do. But then a couple of things happened. Number one, instead of going away from Gilead, as we thought we were doing in the 90s, we turned around and started to come back towards it, as we are doing now. So all of a sudden it seemed more pertinent to hear more, particularly more about what may have caused Gilead to fall apart, why it did not last. I've always been interested in why those kinds of regimes don't last. So I also wanted to think about what it would be like for the second generation, because it's always very different for second generations.
I'm really fascinated by the character of Agnes. We meet her when she's describing her life as a schoolgirl, although school means something very different when you're not taught to read and write. It's interesting that even though she sees things that disturb her about the place she's from, she's a child of Gilead.
How can she help it?
Yeah.
She has no other perspective. She has no access to anything that she could compare it with, except what she's told within the society.
And I think she requires us to ask what it is about our own society that we don't recognize as wrong or strange or twisted.
Yes, what are we teaching the kids?
Right, right.
And is what we're teaching the kids accurate? Is it true? Is it enough? And every generation of parents and teachers, I think, always wonders that at some point. I had an education that completely left out the recent history of indigenous people. We just weren't told anything about it. We had a lot about World War II, because it was very much on people's minds right then. But these other histories, we just didn't learn about.
It is interesting when you find out that there's something that was left out of your education, and some things were left out of my education as well. And you realize that you were lied to by omission. But what it did really was preserve a certain kind of story about where you came from.
It preserved decorum. So it gave a unified narrative, and people are always looking for unified narratives. Because chaos and anarchy and conflicting points of view are sort of hard to assimilate. And young children in particular want things to be clear. They want there to be good guys and bad guys, and they want to be on the side of the good guys. But in very scrambled history, there sometimes aren't, in fact, quite often there are not, people who are entirely good and other people who are entirely bad.
There's so much fear in these stories. And I think the thing that people are most afraid of is women, which is really interesting to me.
They're most afraid of women getting out, as it were, mm-hmm. women getting out of the box. Well, that takes us right back to ancient Greece. Classical Greece, there was nothing that scared them more than women being cut loose. They just found that pretty terrifying, which is why they're so fixated on stories about Amazons, these women warriors, who were based on real women warriors. The Scythians had women warriors. But for the Greeks, that was a real conundrum because women were supposed to be inferior. And what if there was a woman warrior who was the equivalent of you? How terrifying. and wore pants and had full body tattoos.
Which is where we are today.
Well, I don't know. And they're not riding horses and shooting bows and arrows, but apart from that, yeah, pants and body tattoos are amongst us.
Blood is a through line in this story, and blood is something that, you know, we associate it with life and we associate it with death. It can purify and it can contaminate, and women's bodies are a reminder of this every 28 days.
That is true. And does that come into the story a lot? Yes, it does come in somewhat. It's important because in Gilead, your main thing is to have babies, if you can. So naturally, blood is interwoven into the story, and so are bloodlines, who is related to whom. Because in Gilead, with all of these stolen children, you have to keep track of that so you don't end up marrying your daughter.
And Aunt Lydia quite literally knows where the bodies are buried.
Aunt Lydia knows where the bodies are buried, and that gives her quite a lot of power. So somebody in the society would have to have had custody of the actual bloodlines. They would have to know whose child is really whose. And it's the aunts who are well placed to know that. And it's secret knowledge. It's hidden. Other people don't have it. And by having those secrets, they also acquire other secrets. So think of them as the J. Edgar Hoovers of their time.
When you wrote The Handmaid's Tale, did you think very much about what Gilead looked like from the perspective of Aunt Lydia?
Not a lot when I was writing it. So people who get into those positions of power are either true believers, or they're opportunists, or both, or they're climbing their way up the ladder out of fear. So if they don't acquire a position of power, somebody else is going to, and then they will be very vulnerable. So when you look at the regimes of people like Hitler and Stalin, and who were the functionaries and the executors, if you like, who did the bidding of those at the very tippity top, each one of them has a backstory. How did they get where they were? And why?
So we have Aunt Lydia's story here. She's one of the three narrators, and it's hard to tell whether her story is a confession or a justification or a combination.
You know, they're always kind of both.
Mm-hmm.
So she's hiding her confession or justification inside a book inside her secret library called Apologia Pro Vita Sua by Cardinal Newman. And it's very hard to write a story of your life. I don't know whether you've ever tried it.
I have not.
Well, there is a tendency to make yourself come out good.
I can imagine, of course.
Yeah, sometimes there's a tendency to say, here's all the bad things I did, or here's all the things bad things I've did, but I'm not that person anymore, and I've repented of them. So that would be the true sort of confession in the Augustinian style.
Aunt Lydia knows that readers, if they ever discover this text that she's leaving behind, will judge her.
Of course, as we do when we're reading it.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. I judged her, but I realized I might not have always made different decisions. If I had to be honest with how I might respond to the kind of condition she was put in, I can't guarantee that I would have done the right thing.
Yes. Would you have allowed yourself to be shot rather than do the things that she did?
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to in those regimes. So it's not just going along to get along. It's going along to avoid being killed.
She's very good with people, even though she's not an easy person to get along with.
She's very good at reading people, and she's very good at manipulating people. So we see her showing us and telling us how she does that. But you would have to be good at those things if you were in that position. I'm just reading a long biography of Thomas Cromwell, who was the hench person of Henry VIII. And he also must have been a very good reader of people because he was an ace manipulator. And he also had a secret agenda. So he was an evangelical at a time when being an evangelical, if it were known, would get you burned at the stake. So although he was doing all these awful things on behalf of Henry VIII and heads were rolling, he was placing people of his persuasion and belief into key positions of power.
You give Aunt Lydia a sense of humor.
You know, I think she has one in The Handmaid's Tale. She quotes quite a bit, and she makes some pretty bad puns, even in that book. Because we have access to her secret journal, we can see her indulging that tendency quite a bit more.
We learn about the circumstances under which she was brought into the regime, and they're terrifying. It's in what today is Boston, right? Mm-hmm. before the United States falls to Gilead. It must be strange to think about places that are familiar and sort of safe and comforting and imagine them turned inside out.
Well, traveling in Eastern Europe as I did, I saw a lot of repurposed buildings. You know, once it was this, now it's that. And even in Paris, you can find buildings that were used by the Nazi occupation. There will be a plaque on them on the wall. Some of them were hotels, for instance. Now they're hotels again. But it's quite usual for places to be repurposed when there's a regime change.
We're listening back to my conversation from September with Margaret Atwood, author of The Handmaid's Tale and the new follow-up, The Testaments. Coming up, the dystopian world in Atwood's novel was crafted by adhering to one key rule, and it wasn't fiction.
Nothing was supposed to go into the book for which there wasn't a precedent in real life. Sometime, somewhere in history, or now, people had to have done or be doing the same kind of thing.
That's when the best of Think continues. This is Think. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. My guest is novelist Margaret Atwood. Her newest book is The Testaments, a follow-up to her 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale. Let's return to the conversation from September. Is it unusual for you to go back and reread something that you've published decades ago?
It's not really, really, really usual. I think it's going to be usual in the upcoming years because I'm probably going to want to go back and see what I was doing. But of course, any author will tell you that you go back and you read it and you think, oh, I should have put a comma there. Oh, that I should have cut that sentence. So you start editing when it's way too late.
Were there any rules that you created for yourself in setting up Gilead in the original novel that were a problem for you with this one, or that you found were surprisingly useful to you?
So the rules were similar in that nothing was supposed to go into the book for which there wasn't a precedent in real life. Sometime, somewhere in history or now, people had to have done or be doing the same kind of thing. So that rule was not difficult because there is no shortage of material. The things that are always more difficult are trying to imagine the language of the future. Hmm. And for the Testaments, particularly the teenage language of the future. So would it be the same as the teenage language of today? No, it wouldn't, because teenage language changes at the speed of light. As soon as you think you found out what the new cool word is, it isn't.
So how did you give a voice to Daisy?
Process of elimination. I put in more swearing at first and then realized, partly through my editor saying, that's too much swearing. took more of it out. So you're looking for a voice that's readable and plausible, but not just in your face all the time with the teenage slang.
It's curious to think about Daisy's situation. She is raised in Canada. She has a sort of fascination with what's happened in Gilead, with this missing baby, but she doesn't ever imagine that she will find herself there.
No, not at all, because why would you go there?
Right.
So it's presented to kids who are not in Gilead as really the bad place. So all of these bad things are going on there. They're not going on here. Why would you ever want to go there? And this is just a hark back to the Cold War and what kids were taught about how awful it was behind the Iron Curtain. Not always true, but certainly very negative. You wouldn't want to be there. You wouldn't want to live there.
What was your first exposure to the reality that things weren't exactly the same behind the Iron Curtain as what was described to you? I remember I visited Russia in the 90s, and I thought, oh, these are people who love their kids, and they enjoy going to the park. I mean, they've had a lot of hardships, but they weren't fundamentally different from us in the way that I'd been raised to believe.
The ordinary people were not. I think it's when you got to the upper echelons of interpurging and show trials. But by the 90s, that was over. So the heyday of that was the 30s and 40s and 50s. So here, if you want to get rid of a politician, you diselect them. There they would shoot them in the back of the head. So it's a little bit different.
Canada is rightly proud of its history as being a safe haven for escaped slaves. And obviously there are many parallels between the stories of the women of Gilead and enslaved African Americans in the United States. How much did you think about that, and at what point did you have to set those parallels aside and just tell your own stories?
Well, I thought about them quite a lot, particularly in terms of escape routes. Like, how would you get out? What would the pathways be? What bodies of water would you have to cross? What would the kicking off point be? Who would be helping you? All of those sorts of things would be important. But it's not just escaping slaves going to Canada. It's escaping anybody going anywhere. Hmm. So I also had in mind quite a bit the escape routes in Europe during World War II, in which people in the underground would help downed airmen, downed Allied airmen, get out, usually through either Spain or Sweden or Switzerland. And there were people that would pass these people along from location to location and get them out. The coast of Maine has been a smuggler's haven and also an escape route for centuries. And you can trace that all the way back. So it's no accident that Bangor is where the Offred's manuscript is found. And it's also no accident that it appears again in the Testaments, because that was one of the routes that people would take. So during those days, it was either by land or by sea. Those were the two ways that you could go. It wasn't by air yet. There weren't any airplanes.
In the sort of academic conference that follows both the books, we learn that Bangor has been renamed Passamaquoddy, and that's a really interesting choice.
Well, you find a certain amount of renaming going on already in our own times. A number of names that were English language names put onto indigenous locations have now been renamed with their original indigenous name. So I just speeded that up.
I wanted all the people helping women escape from Gilead to be heroes, but you let us know that some of them are mercenaries. Some of them are just there to make money.
No kidding. It has always been so, because you are risking your life. And some people are willing to risk their lives to do those things. And a lot of mercenaries are involved in moving people from country to country, even as we speak. And some of them are ripoff artists. You know, they'll take the money and then just set you afloat. So that has been going on over the past little while, too. It was the Vietnam boat people, a lot of that went on. People trying to cross the Mediterranean to get away from war zones in the Middle East are frequently just cast adrift. You know, people take the money, just cast them adrift. And it can be a bit of a combination of both. You know, I'm willing to help you, but I'd like to be paid.
Hmm. Yeah, I thought you have some characters in a raft at one point with someone that they don't know how much they can trust. And I thought about people escaping Syria who are on these, you know, they're sold life vests that aren't necessarily filled with anything that will keep them afloat.
You know, there are all kinds of bad things that people want to make money out of. And they don't much care about the risk to the other people. So that goes on whenever there are opportunities like this, but you can see it going on in many other areas of life, such as the recent scandal about the opiate peddling. You know, people made fortunes caring nothing about what was happening to the people who were being convinced that this is something they should take, that they should buy and swallow.
We learned that Agnes was very much loved by the mother she knew, the woman she knew as her mother. And that's such a left, it's a curveball thrown at us, because we want everything to be terrible, and not everything was. Aunt Lydia recognizes it, that there are, you know, people love their children in any kind of society, even one that is sort of rotting at its core.
What else is new? Of course. And especially when children are they're in somewhat short supply, they're going to be loved and cherished by some people. Of course they will be.
Not enough to protect female children from what will happen. You know, often, even in the current world of Me Too, men who join the movement as allies will say, this is because I'm thinking about my daughters. That doesn't seem to happen with the men of Gilead.
Well, they do think they're thinking about their daughters. What they want for them is what a lot of societies want for daughters, which is a safe, lucrative marriage.
Hmm.
That's what they want.
For as long as it lasts.
The safe, lucrative marriage is supposed to last forever, because Gilead does not sanction divorce. So they want the daughter well-placed. They want her well-placed before something else might happen, such as her falling in love with an inappropriate person and getting stoned to death. So when there are a lot of negatives to not getting married young and having a safe marriage, when there are a lot of those negatives, of course they think they're acting in the best interest of the child because the alternatives are bad. Dangerous, yeah.
The young women of Gilead are taught, they're very much taught to fear men, and that anything that they do, if they slip up in any way, they will be responsible for.
Welcome to the 1950s.
So is that something that, did you relate to that from growing up, those ideas?
That was certainly what was put out there. Mm-hmm. Because my family was somewhat unusual, I didn't buy it, but it was certainly the story. And it was the story that if you wore revealing clothing, that then it would be your fault if something came as a result of that. And there was a lot of your faultness applied to young women.
So if you were raised in a family that meant that you didn't buy it and you were sort of free of that, did you still feel social pressure to act as if you bought it?
Natürlich. Of course I did. Of course I did. I wasn't a lunatic. Yes, I mean, in any society, if you don't want immediate trouble, you have a facade. And the facade is a facade that gets you through the day in an easeful fashion without too much uproar going on.
I couldn't decide what to think about the religion in Gilead. On the one hand, it's pretty clear that it is simply a tool used to justify and exercise power. There seems to be a lot of prayer going on, but no one really seems to buy it entirely. Everyone seems to think everyone else believes it. Or if I'm incorrect in that assessment,
yeah,
let me know.
I think some people buy it. I think Tabitha buys it in a good way. So the woman who's the adoptive mother of Agnes. I think Agnes, to a certain extent, herself buys it. And I think some of the teachers in the school buy it. I think Aunt Estée buys it. I think Aunt Videla buys it in a sadistic way. So with any religion, there are going to be some people for whom it is a comfort, some people for whom it is a tool of power, some people who really believe it, some people who are opportunists, some people who for whom it is just a social thing that you do because other people are doing it. And that is true of any religion that you can name, and there's an assortment of those people in the Testaments.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The other thing that all women, except for the aunts, under very limited circumstances, are prevented from doing is reading. And and for me as a reader, certainly, I imagine for you as a writer and reader, it almost feels like torture to imagine a life without ever reading another word.
Yes, but if you didn't know how to in the first place, you wouldn't miss it, would you? So why is it removed from girls and women? So they won't get into the Bible, into the more revolutionary parts of the Bible in which people talk about being set free, in which people talk about loving everyone. Can't have that. And other things that might be problematic to the leaders of Gilead, such as female prophetesses, Deborah, leader of her people, the Ruth and Naomi story, they wouldn't want that. So it allows them to selectively choose and also alter the text without other people, such as girls and women, being able to check them up.
In some ways, the male perspective on everything is everywhere because it governs society, but it's the one perspective that we don't get directly in the book. And it made me think a lot about the ways that patriarchy does also limit men. It is also bad for men, ultimately, even if they have more power within a society.
Well, okay, so let us think what it would be like to have a society without those kinds of power structures. Because it's all very well to say this is bad and that is bad, but you also have to have Plan B.
Yeah.
So what would Plan B look like? Plan B might look something like a hunter-gatherer society. Plan B might look something like the nomadic Scythians, in which a woman on horseback with the bow and arrow was pretty much the equivalent of a man on horseback with the bow and arrow, so they did have women warriors. Let us look at societies in which women did have more power. What were they like? I don't think we've ever had a society in which women had all the power. I don't think we've seen that. But if you'd like to read about it, it's in a book by Naomi Alderman called The Power, in which women have suddenly developed the ability to electrocute people at will. That changes the power balance. And then we can follow the story and see what happens. So what would it be like? I think what is probably bad for men, as you observed the last 4,000 years of human history, is that they become very competitive within these kinds of structures and end up killing one another quite a lot.
We see women taking care of one another, and we also see women selling each other out in these stories, which of course is going to happen when your oppressors put you under so much strain that you either survive or find some way around the system.
You mean why are people competitive and self-interested?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess you're just articulating human nature.
Yeah, I don't think it's just the patriarchy or it's just Gilead. I think we all have these components. We all have these possibilities. And a social structure will either encourage a certain set of them or discourage a certain set of them. And in societies where sharing and equality are valued, then people share and act more equally. And in societies where competition is valued, then they're more competitive.
We're listening back this hour to my conversation from September with best-selling author Margaret Atwood about her book, The Testaments. Coming up, why issues of justice like climate change, voting rights, and education are critical to combating oppression.
If you get uprisings, if you get wars, the people who are going to be hardest hit are always women and children, because it's easy to take their stuff.
That's when the best of Think continues. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Margaret Atwood. Her new novel, The Testaments, picks up years after the story of the character Offred in Handmaid's Tale. The release produced the best one-day sales of any title from Penguin Random House in 2019. We spoke to Atwood in September. Let's return to that conversation. I had to laugh, Margaret, at the secession of the Republic of Texas that follows as a consequence of the rise of Gilead throughout much of the rest of the United States, because, of course, Texas would ultimately secede. Can you talk about throwing that detail in there?
Well, you know, I have a long history with Texas. I spent some time here a while ago. And it began as a kind of separate land space. And there's always been a certain amount of agitation one way or another. I just thought it would be interesting to make a separate Republic of Texas.
I also like the fact that the ants have their tea at the Schlafly Cafe.
Yes, that was naughty. It has pink tablecloths.
Let's go on the phone to, I believe it's another Margaret in McKinney, Texas. Hi.
A lot of the oppression that you reflect in the book seems to be a direct correlation to black people who are enslaved here in the United States.
You know what, Margaret? I'm so sorry. We're having trouble hearing you, but I see by the comments that were written for me beforehand that you wanted to ask about the relationship between the story of The Handmaid's Tale and the direct historical stories of people enslaved and how religion and things were used to justify that. I hope that I'm getting your question down or your statement.
That's entirely correct. Mm-hmm. It's not limited to that because it's been used in other parts of the world for similar reasons as well. But certainly details such as not being allowed to read, which was illegal for people who were enslaved, and therefore the use of religion to tell them why it was so that they should have that position, that certainly went on a lot in this country then, for sure.
Why do you think we always assume that terrible things like this slavery, genocide, systematic oppression of different kinds of people. Why do we always assume when we get past a period of this that it will never happen again?
So I suppose because we're hopeful. And it's also a way of saying, oh, well, you don't have to worry about that anymore because it's over,
mm-hmm.
like that. I think it was certainly downplayed in the educational system for quite a long time. Like, that was bad. Let's talk about something else. The thing that has been rediscovered in recent years also is the genocidal massacres that went on against indigenous people in this country. Quite a few of them that we didn't know about before are now coming to light and being talked about.
And they weren't, when I was taught about these things as a child, it was always presented almost as an accidental consequence of contact between colonizers and indigenous people.
Oh, I think it was pretty deliberate.
I recognize that now.
Yeah.
But yeah. The idea was that, as if North America and South America, for that matter, were empty when Europeans arrived.
That was not the case, but it was the case that the diseases often ran ahead of the actual arrival of people, so that some parts, when they got there, were empty because the diseases had got there first, and these people had no immunity to them, so they killed everyone. And the death rate during those 2 centuries after contact is estimated at something like 90%. It was huge.
What do you think life is like for boys in Gilead? How do you train someone to be oppressive and to assume that they have sort of inherited everything that they see?
Well, you don't tell them they're being oppressive. You tell them they're being protective. And doing the right thing and doing God's will and all the kinds of stuff that people were told. You don't have to turn the clock back very far, either in this country or in, say, England, to see how people were educated and what they were told and what they therefore believed. And they were very much told, this is your place, and of course it is a superior place because you are a superior being. And here are all the ways in which you are superior. And I go back to a feminist classic of I think the early 70s called Why Are There No Great Female Artists? And it's kind of all there.
Mm-hmm.
You know? All the beliefs that women had smaller brains, that they weren't creative. And then she goes into the sociological reasons for why women did not become a certain kind of painter. Basically, they weren't allowed into the art schools because they might see naked people.
Do you find young women, maybe interacting with your work for the first time, have the same kind of anger that women did a generation or two ago about these things?
I think they have a different kind of anger, but they certainly have a lot of anger and a lot of energy, I would say. But they have a couple of kinds of energy, and part of their energy right now, the quite young women, is invested in the climate crisis. So the Extinction Rebellion, a lot of young people are involved in that. But these are not separate issues. It's the oppression of girls and women is joined at the hip with access to food and water, basically. So if you get a famine, if you get a drought, if conditions become unstable, if you get a state of anarchy, if you get uprisings, if you get wars, the people who are going to be hardest hit are always women and children, because it's easy to take their stuff.
We have Ashley calling from Marble Falls, Texas. Hi, Ashley.
Hi. Good afternoon to both of you. Ms. Atwood, I just had a question for you. It seems to me that in Gilead, Gilead is very much a parallel towards the creation of the Christian church in Rome, in which it was basically a power structure. It was created by men for men, and it was used to keep the people who didn't know better in the dark for the longest time. And yet, the handmaids really remind me of Christ's original disciples, in that they were asked to do very courageous things under the cover of darkness, sometimes fearful, unexpected.
Well, what would you say to all that, Margaret?
I think that's quite accurate. When the Christian church first got going, it was quite woman friendly. In fact, a number of the people involved in helping it out and furthering it along were women. And then as it gained power and became a thing, of course, when organizations gain power and become a thing, naturally men want high positions in them. And that's when you get the women being downgraded. And by the way, you saw the same thing in the Russian Revolution. So women were considered comrades and fellow fighters and blah, 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 until they actually won. and then it was going to have to be different. And it was the same in the French Revolution. Hmm. You know, it was women were out there storming the barricades, and then they won. And, of course, now it was time to go back to your homes. And you saw that in World War II. So it was women working the munitions factories in this country, and then there was a concerted effort to get them back into their open-plan bungalow with the washer-dryer. And let's not hear any more about that. So it is a cycle that has repeated itself. And if you would like to read about it, you can get Marilyn French's large work called From Eve to Dawn, which is a history of women from the beginning. So yes, that happened in the Christian church. And oddly enough, I think the 19th century was a particularly bad century in that respect. Women were deprived of rights they had previously had. And in the French Revolution, the woman who wrote the Declaration of the Rights of Women, thinking that maybe now we were going to have liberty, equality, and fraternity, maybe women could be included in that, she ended up on the guillotine.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. One thing that really has changed in our world that not that many people might have imagined in 1985 is the way we communicate now, that we are constantly barraged with information from so many more sources than were even available in the 80s at the era, at the sort of apex of mass media. And I wonder if you thought about those changes and wanted to accommodate them in Gilead in any way, or just sort of recognize that you had already created this world and you needed to stay with that.
Oh, they wouldn't want any social media in Gilead, dear.
Of course. No, I understand that, but they would have
nor
had to
any,
suppress
nor
social
any
media.
Cell phones. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, there's countries who have done that. Hmm. I don't know whether you saw what just happened in Kashmir. They just cut off the whole thing. So these social media networks are dependent on servers, and you can take them down pretty quickly. In the Hulu TV series, we do start out with the women having cell phones, but those disappear pretty quickly. Because what you really don't want to have in this kind of setup is women communicating with one another.
Does it bother you at all that there's any divergence between what you wrote and what the Hulu showrunners have created and sort of added on to Offred's story?
Okay, what they would have had to have done if they had been 100% accurate, they would have had to do it as a period piece. Mm-hmm. And that's always hard when the period is not that far behind us. So it's easier to do a period piece about 1850 because we think we know what that looks like. but to do one about 1985 would be quite difficult. So even a 1985 that's imagining something 20 years ahead of itself would be difficult. So they made the decision to upgrade it to now. And that, of course, changed certain things about the show, but I don't see that they had a lot of choice.
The knock is prescribed, because tonight this room is her domain.
Come in.
It's a little thing, but in this house, little things mean everything.
Good evening. Dear. Now let's get started. And when Rachel saw that she bare Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said unto Jacob, "Give me children, or else I die."
Did the actors have questions for you?
Not the actors, the showrunner. So Bruce Miller. We talk quite a bit. I'm some sort of a, I have a title, which I can never remember either what it is or what it means. But what it really means is that we talk on the phone.
Are there things that they want to do that you just don't want them to do?
We have had a couple of moments like that. So just to put it very clearly, I have influence but no power.
Mm-hmm. That's got to be a strange position for someone like you who has written about worlds where people have influence but no power.
Why so? Is it strange? Yeah, I think it's the position of writers and artists in general. Mm-hmm. People think they have power. They actually don't. What they have is influence. People who have power are lawmakers. Those people have power.
When you create a story, you create a whole world. Some writers will say they feel as if the characters and the plot lines sort of revealed themselves through the process. And some will say, no, I made every single decision after thinking about it. Does it work one way or the other for you?
Yes, it works the first way. Things emerge from the act of storytelling. I did try once to do that other plan in which it was more thought out in advance, and it was a dismal failure. Because I never liked paint by numbers. I don't like just filling in. I think if you are writing a murder mystery, you have to do it that way. Mm-hmm. Because you have to know who done it. So you can strew the false clues around and throw suspicion on innocent people. But if you're writing the kinds of books that I write, you have to go, at least I have to go more or less like feeling my way in the dark.
That was my conversation with Margaret Atwood, author of more than 50 books. Her latest, The Testaments, is a follow-up to her 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale. If you enjoyed this conversation, check out our interview with author Susan Orlean. Her book, The Orchid Thief, was also a bestseller. That podcast is on our website, think.kera.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.